Lecture 4. The Ionian Revolt.
Welcome back. Now that we have gotten to know the protagonists of our epic, the Persians and the Greeks, it's time to return to Sardis, the old capital of the Lydian kingdom, now in the hands of Cyrus the Conqueror, at that moment when he has found that by conquering Lydia, he has brought some of the Greek cities into his realm. Cyrus had so little regard for the Greeks that he didn't even stay around to conquer them himself. He left behind some of his subordinate officers to bring the Greek cities formally into his kingdom. He went rampaging off eastward like a flame, like just a restless source of energy, settling nowhere, capturing Babylon, moving on then into Central Asia to try to bring those horse people into his great kingdom. And that's where he died, trying to add the Central Asiatic plateau to the empire that he had built up in just a single lifetime. He had always wanted the Persians to remain, as we would say, true to their roots and true to that country, Parsa, or Persia, down in the southern part of modern Iran. There was a time in his own life where his fellow Persians wanted him to move the population out of that upland plateau, that harsh land, down onto the plains where all the rich cities were and all the beautiful life, and live like conquerors. Well, Cyrus was well aware of where that would lead. He knew what had become of the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Akkadians and all the ones before who had gone the way of empire and soon become soft. And so he said to these people, these Persians, you know, rough country breeds rough men and hard men. Soft countries breed soft men. Which do you want to be? Do you want to live in a hard country and rule others, or live in a soft land and be ruled yourself? Well, when they put it that way, they all agreed. And so there was no move out of Persia, the traditional homeland, in Cyrus's lifetime. Instead, he created an odd sort of capital city called Pasargadae, up there in the original plateau. And that was a place where he had little palaces dotted around a park, what the Persians called a paradesos. That's the origin of the word paradise in the Bible. Paradise, we should remember, is a cultivated piece of land with trees growing in it, wild animals for the king to hunt, vast tracts of grassland, a wall around it, or some sort of delimitation, and the idea that people are in there tending it. And we should never forget that in the book of Genesis, that paradesos, which is the Garden of Eden, is a place where Adam is put to work it and to be looking after God's paradesos. Well, Cyrus created a beautiful paradesos. He inculcated in his line of Achaemenid kings a great love for trees. One of the images that the kings of Persia like to use of themselves is, we are the gardeners of our realm. We make things grow. And so paradesos meant that Pasargadae was more about growing things than about the little palaces and houses that were dotted around in it. When Cyrus died, his body was brought back to Pasargadae. They built up on a flight of stone steps, a pedestal of stone steps, a little thing that looks like a wooden cabin turned into stone with a gabled roof, no elaborate inscriptions, no beautiful reliefs, and there in that humble place, the body of the first and greatest of the conquering Persian kings was laid to rest. It was up to his successors to deal with the great empire that this restless, fiery person, Cyrus, had created. And his son Cambyses, who conquered Egypt, and Cambyses' successor Darius, who then added India, or at least Pakistan and the Indus Valley of northwest India, to the empire on the east, and who added Scythia, parts of Russia, the Ukraine, and Eastern Europe on the west, they realized that they were in charge of administering a realm that could not be governed from a small upland valley. So they chose the old Elamite city of Susa, one of the great metropolises of Asia, as their administrative capital for their new empire. But they wanted to be true to Cyrus's vision of the homeland, the place called Parsa, which gives us both the word Persian in English, and in the Indo-European languages that went further east, Farsi in India, which was the designation for the Persians who'd crossed down into the Indian subcontinent. Parsa was a place they wanted to commemorate. And so at a place that they called Parsa and that the Greeks called Persepolis, city of the Persians, they built, under Darius and Xerxes, a great ceremonial center, what we call Persepolis. Now, Persepolis was a capital of sorts, but it was a capital that was meant to be the emotional, spiritual heart of the realm, not the administrative, governing heart of the realm. And so at Persepolis, Darius and then his son Xerxes brought together from all parts of the empire building materials and craftsmen. As far away as Ionia, Greeks were recruited or forced into labor groups to come to that high upland plateau and at Persepolis create the most magnificent palace anyone had ever seen. The columns soared up to the sky. They were crowned with capitals that, instead of being little floral motifs, were capitals like pairs of bulls yoked together at the midriff, or strange lions. And they decorated the walls. The Ionians clearly did a lot of the artwork, but they were joined by the Lydians, and the Phoenicians sent cedar of Lebanon for the roof beams. The whole empire was involved. But the artists created on the walls images of the Persians and their subject peoples. So, for instance, you could see Persian spearmen with their light round shields, their spears, and those distinctive upright crown-like helmets or hats that the Persians wore into battle. Elsewhere, and dominating the art of Persepolis, you saw images in stone of the ceremonies that Persepolis was created in order to enshrine. And those ceremonies seem to have been the annual New Year festivities, where the kings of Persia would summon to Persepolis, that remote place, representatives of every tribe, every nation, every kingdom within their empire. Those peoples would come and they would bring tribute and gifts to the great king. Now, we talked in the first lecture about Cyrus and his initial conquest of the Medes and their kingdom of Media. The Medes had been civilized much longer than the Persians had, and those Median officials, who were shown with sort of rounded hats or turbans, and always, like the Persians themselves, wearing trousers, something that the Greeks considered truly barbaric, trousers for riding, sometimes with kilts also, they were shown all over the reliefs of Persepolis, these Medes, leading, sometimes leading by the hand, like school children in a queue, the representatives of the subject nations, through the passageways, along the corridors, up the flights of steps, stone versions of the living people who were walking by them once a year. The Medes were shown carrying flowers, another symbol of the gardening that went on in the Persian Empire. They pass between little trees that look like Christmas trees to us, and they are leading people who are bringing camels, horses. The Ionians are shown bringing wool cloth, and they are wearing the trailing garments for which they were famous. All of these people are shown coming to Persepolis to worship the king. Now, it was in this way that the Ionian Greeks got to know the heartland of the Persian Empire. Some of their important people, their important leaders, became attached to the court of King Darius, were among his advisors. Many of their craftsmen had been taken out of their homes, forced to march almost 2,000 miles to that high valley to create this beautiful palace. And each year, some Ionians would participate in that great ceremony. You would have thought that the message they got from all this was, these people are kings of the world. No puny little group like us Greeks could hope to challenge them. But it didn't work out that way. Somehow, by about the year 500 BC, 22 years after King Darius began to reign and began to get to know the Greeks of Ionia very well, the Ionians decided to rebel from the Persians, to stage a revolt, break away, and liberate themselves. But they knew that they couldn't do it alone. They would need help. After all, the Persians were watching them at all times. There was a very heavy security system imposed upon you when you became part of the Persian Empire. And they looked across the Aegean Sea to the old mother country of Greece, and to the great hoplite phalanx of Sparta, heavily armed infantry that was the most famous in the Greek world, to come across the sea and save them. So the leader of that Ionian city of Miletus, a man named Aristagoras, relying on that great scientific revolution that had happened in his city, took one of the city's treasures, a bronze map of the world that showed Greece and the Aegean and the Persian Empire. He took it on board a ship, and he had himself rowed or sailed across the Aegean Sea to the Peloponnese, and he made his way to Sparta. And there, in front of the kings of Sparta, Sparta, unlike most of the Greek city-states of the mainland, was still nominally a kingdom. It had two kings from two different royal houses, but they were really just generals for life and ceremonial leaders. This was not a monarchy, not an autocracy like the Persian Empire, and the Spartan kings were not even politically the most powerful force within the land. That was a little council of five ephors, and ultimately the assembly of the Spartan warriors. So Aristagoras talked to one of the kings, a man named Cleomenes, and he showed him the bronze map. And he traced for Cleomenes on the sheet of bronze what the Ionians had learned about this great Persian empire. "Here," he said, pointing with his finger, "here is Ionia beside the sea. Next to Ionia is Lydia, that fabulously wealthy kingdom. Next to Lydia, as you go toward the rising sun, toward the east, is Phrygia, a land famous for its cattle and its crops. Next to Phrygia, Cappadocia. Next to Cappadocia, Cilicia. Next to Cilicia, Armenia." And as he's in Armenia, he's starting to move into the mountainous area that lies north of the headwaters of the Tigris and the Euphrates River. "Next to Armenia, Mytilene." And now he's coming down into Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers. He's gotten to the far side of the Tigris. And finally, he said, "Cilicia or Cilicia. And in Cilicia is the great city of Susa, at the end of this great road. And in Susa lives the great king of the Persians, and there is all of his treasure. Zeus himself would not be more rich than you would be if you would go to Susa, conquer the Persians, and capture their treasure." Cleomenes, the Spartan king, said to Aristagoras, the Milesian, "How long is this trip?" Now, we talked about the royal road two lectures ago when we talked about the Persian Empire, this great unpaved but carefully leveled highway on which the king's messengers, his riders who relayed his letters and orders, and his armies would pass. Aristagoras had probably been on that road, and he said, "Well, from Ionia to Susa, it takes 3 months." And the king of Sparta said, "Get out. It is a very bad thing to ask Spartans to march 3 months away from the sea. I will listen to you no more." Aristagoras tried to bribe him, and there's a charming addition to the tale that Herodotus tells. Cleomenes had a little daughter named Gorgo, and she saw the stranger Aristagoras approaching her father again, and she said, "Send him away, father, or he will corrupt you." Now, no Spartan ever wants to be corrupted by filthy lucre, so Aristagoras was sent packing. He went to Athens, which at that time was a second-rate power, but it was the mother city of the Ionians, and he expected a better hearing. And as Herodotus says, it proved easier to fool 30 or 40,000 Athenians in their democratic assembly than it had been to fool one Spartan king. Herodotus thought the whole Ionian revolt was a terrible idea. At any rate, Aristagoras repeated the show with the map. He convinced the Athenians they should try it, and they agreed to send him some ships and some men to support the revolt that would liberate, as they hoped, Ionia from the Persian yoke. These Athenians marshaled in 20 ships, open galleys that were the descendants of the Argo that had taken Jason in quest of the Golden Fleece, possibly ships in which the warriors themselves pulled the oars and rowed, as they would have done back in the old heroic days, possibly the trireme, the larger ships on three tiers, we'll learn more about them in a little bit, that were originally troop ships and transport ships. At any rate, 20 ships carried several hundred or perhaps a few thousand Athenian warriors across the sea from Athens eastward to Ionia. And they were accompanied by six ships of another central Greek city-state, Eretria, on the island of Euboea, just north of Athens. They also went along. These were the only supporters in the old Greek heartland for the Ionian Rebellion. 20 Athenian ships, 6 Eretrian ships also. They landed at Ephesus. Persians did not know they'd arrived. They crossed over the hills, the 60 miles to Sardis, probably took them a march that would get them to Sardis on the third day. They came down on Sardis, completely unsuspecting city, at dawn, and they captured the lower city. The Persian garrison and the Persian governor fled up to the high pinnacle of the hill by the city where the Acropolis was, the citadel, and held out there. And somehow, either by accident or by design, a fire was lit in Sardis and the city burned to the ground, the greatest city that the Persians held among their administrative capitals in Asia Minor. A terrible blow, and to the horror of the local people, the temple of the mother goddess, Cybele, C-Y-B-E-L-E, that burned too. Now, the burning of a temple was a terrible desecration in the ancient world, and those people of Asia never forgot or forgave the Ionians and their Athenian accomplices for having destroyed that temple. The Greeks, finding that they couldn't capture the Persians up in the citadel, decided to make their way back to Ephesus, but they were caught on the way by a counterattack of the Persians, and they were very badly beaten in a battle. The Athenians barely got away with their ships and their lives, and they resolved to have no more to do with the Ionians. Something that had happened in that initial attempt had convinced the Athenians that went that A, the Ionians were not to be relied on as allies, and B, they had been sold a bill of goods. Persia was not this easy pushover of a place that a few men and a few ships could hope to topple. So the mainlanders withdrew, the people of the motherland, the Athenians and the Eretrians, pulled out of the Ionian revolt. But the cities of the Greeks in Asia Minor all rose up in rebellion throughout their Persian rulers. And the Persian rulers, by the way, were mainly Quislings, local Greeks who were in the pay of the Persians to govern their fellow Greeks. These were run out, and the whole of Ionia for 6 years was independent. And the rebellion spread all the way to Cyprus, where there were, that was then also a divided island between Greeks and Asiatic. The Greeks there also rebelled. Well, the Persians are relentless. They may be slow to get things together, but when they do, there's no stopping them. And they sent armies and navies up to Ionia in order to end the Ionian revolt. Now, the big problem for the Persians was they had not up to this time been a seafaring people. There is one story that said that the great king himself should not go to sea, that that was not an element where the Persians should be. Nonetheless, if they were going to safeguard their western frontier, which now was on the coast of the Aegean, they had to have ships. Fortunately, just as the Romans, centuries later, conquered the Greek cities of southern Italy and added these naval allies, as they called them, to their growing empire, the Persians had also conquered maritime cities and nations. Cambyses had conquered Egypt. The Egyptians had a fleet. The Phoenicians of modern Lebanon, those seagoing Canaanites from their centers like Tyre and Sidon and Byblos, they had hundreds of warships, great triremes, triple-tiered ships, in which they had circumnavigated Africa, in which they had planted colonies way to the west at Carthage. They had hundreds of these ships to now answer the king's call, and ships elsewhere in Asia Minor, like Cilicia, a famous nest of pirates, they were added to the ship roll. And in this way, King Darius put together a fleet of 600 warships, according to Herodotus, and sent them west to bring the Ionians back into the empire. The Ionian cities were either on islands like Lesbos and Chios and Samos, or they were on the mainland, but connected to the sea, so that as long as they had their walls and a connection to the sea, their friends from the islands could supply them with food. And you could never take those cities by starving them out. So Darius realized, I've got to beat them at sea. I must destroy their naval power. The Ionians learned that this great armada of 600 ships or so was coming at them. with the core of that navy, the fearsome Phoenicians, who were very well known for their seagoing exploits, but perhaps not so well known for their fighting at sea. At any rate, just in terms of sheer numbers, it was a terrifying prospect because the Ionians could only muster 353 ships to face this horde almost double that size. The Ionians had great islands like Chios that contributed 100 ships. Other cities, the Ephesians, the city of Miletus, the island of Samos also contributed ships. Lesbos contributed ships. So we go from a 100-ship contingent on the island of Chios down to the smallest contingent of all, 3 ships from that little city-state of Phocaea that was part of Ionia on the mainland of Asia. But there was in charge of the Phocaean contingent of just 3 ships a superman of strong will and organizational genius named Dionysius. And even though his contingent was the smallest, he stood up in the council. And remember, these are Ionians. They're all going to debate everything rather than having a king to tell them what they're going to do and give them their orders. They gather together, they take votes on what to do, and Dionysius stands up and says, "If you are willing to undergo toil, trouble, hardship, and privation to train yourselves for this battle that is to come, you can win. It's a short time of effort and denial of comforts that will lead to everlasting freedom." Well, who's going to resist that? Certainly not the Ionians. So even though Dionysius was the leader of the smallest group, he was put in charge of the whole fleet. And he said, "We are going to train." Now, they were off Miletus, which was the greatest of the Ionian cities and the one that had the most to lose in terms of having started the whole thing by sending their leader Aristagoras to Greece to recruit the Athenian help. They were in the 6th year now of their revolt, and everything obviously rested on the success of this battle. And there were sort of wars of nerves that were going on at the same time. King Darius had all of the former leaders who had been ruling the Ionian cities on his behalf, the Ionian leaders he'd appointed, now send messages to the different people saying, "If you will just come back into the Persian fold, you will be spared. If you do not, you will be destroyed." So they're trying to get at people's morale and work it away. At the same time, Dionysius is making them train. Now, these ships that they're in, these triremes, they're about 120 feet long. They have oars at 3 levels, probably 170 oars in each ship. So that's 170 men and 30 or 40 who are additional sailors and marines and pilots and lookouts. And they do have a sail, but the sail doesn't matter in battles. They take out the mast and the sail, leave it on shore, and just row. All those oars are like an engine, and each ship is in essence, if you want it to be, a torpedo, because it has as its beak a bronze ram that can punch through, sink, and destroy an enemy ship. And this was what Dionysius wanted them to do. The old-fashioned way of fighting at sea is the same way the Vikings fought at sea. You bring a whole lot of ships side to side, and then the armed men drop their oars, grab their weapons, and just slug it out on floating wooden platforms. Very primitive, very unscientific. Requires no skill on the part of the pilots or the rowers. Dionysius wanted to train them to be a super force of rowers, pilots, lookouts, who could turn their ships into missiles. Remember, one stroke from a ram can eliminate a couple of hundred of the enemy at a blow. Whereas an individual archer shooting from a deck or throwing his spear from a deck, one weapon, one kill. It just wasn't an effective way to fight, especially when you're outnumbered. So every day, those ships were taken away from shore. They spent the whole day at sea. He did not allow the Ionians to go ashore and have their midday meal as they normally did. Triremes were amphibious ships that were always drawn up on shore at night and went back out to sea during the day. They had very shallow drafts. So from dawn to dusk, day after day, 7 days in a row, Dionysius kept them at it. And the maneuver they were learning was called the diec plus. Dia is the Greek for through. Ek is out, and plus is what a ship does in the water. We have to say ships sail in the water because our English language is very deficient in words for ships moving at sea. We still say even things like the Queen Mary sails. I've even seen people talking about submarines or stern wheel paddle ships having sailing dates. The Greeks were better. They've got that word plus for ships moving in the water through and out. What are they moving through and then out of? The enemy line. He was teaching the crews of rowers, the Ionians, and their pilots to break through an enemy line, come out the other side, turn, and then come back and aim their rams at targets. This was very scientific. It took a lot of skill, a lot of focus, discipline, concentration, hard work, no heavy dinners in the middle of the day. And on the eighth day, the Ionians staged another revolt. They revolted against Dionysius the Phocaean. They said, "This is worse than being the slaves of the Persians. We never dreamed that this would happen to us when we put our defense into the hands of this madman. Why should we suffer this way? We can win the battle without this. Let us go sit in the shade." And that's what they did. And Dionysius found he had a mutiny on his hands and realized that now the cards were stacked against them. So the Phoenicians came into view. The fleet of the Greeks, the Ionians, scrambled to its places and faced them. But they were a group who had now mutinied against discipline, failed to complete their training, had been assaulted individually by messages from their former pro-Persian leaders urging them to come back in the fold. It was a fleet already rife with division, weakened by disunity. And this probably is what Herodotus, the descendant of the Greeks of Halicarnassus, had against the Ionians, was they just couldn't seem to unite for anything. And they seemed infirm of purpose where discipline and self-denial were involved. This was the time that called for it, and they proved lacking. As the Persians came into view, the two sets of ships, the two fleets, came together and collided. The Phoenician ships fighting for the Persians had enough that they could actually start to wrap around the ends of the Greek line. Seemingly, as this happened, as I would read the description in Herodotus, some of the individual contingents of the fleet, the Greek fleet, the Ionian fleet, panicked and decided to save themselves. Remember, they are a temporary alliance of otherwise disunified cities. They're not one national fleet. And so, starting with the islanders of Samos, followed by the islanders of Lesbos, the contingents pull out. The core of the fleet, the 100 ships from the island of Chios, remain true, and to their great honor, there are about a dozen, I think maybe nine, of the Samian ships, those great Samian triremes, remained in their place because their captains refused to retreat with their countrymen and save their own skins at the expense of the common effort. And long afterwards, monuments were put up in the marketplace on the island of Samos to these men who had remained true to their station, had captained their ships right on through the battle, suffered defeat, but had kept the honor of the island strong. However, once the pullouts began, the outcome of this battle was inevitable. It's called the Battle of Lade, L-A-D-E, because the Greek headquarters had been on the little island of Lade, right by Miletus, the city of Miletus. And if you go to Miletus today, you will look in vain for Lade. The sediments from the streams on the coast have spread a delta, a sheet of land, out into the sea and have captured that island. So it's just a little hill. But I urge you to look for the hill, stand upon it, look around you, and imagine that sea filled with the ships of the first great sea battle between the Greeks and the people they called the barbarians, those who spoke a non-Greek tongue. And imagine those fleeing contingents, the Phoenicians taking off after them, and the shattering of the dream of Ionian independence at Lade. That was the last hurrah of the Ionian revolt. And King Darius, when he got the word from his messengers that the Ionian navies had been defeated, that the Ionian revolts shortly after that had collapsed, he was happy, and he knew that he had punished the Ionians for their rebellion, but there was something on his mind. 6 years earlier, Athenians had crossed over in 20 ships and had helped burn Sardis. In an act of unprovoked terror, that must have loomed in his mind, not unlike 9/11 in the American consciousness, people out of nowhere coming and burning a great city near the coast. The Athenians loved to tell the story that when Darius got news of the burning of Sardis in about the year 499 or 498, he took an arrow, fitted it to his bow, shot it into the air, and swore a great oath that he would punish Athens. And he told his cupbearer, the young man who poured his wine at dinner, "At every meal, remind me three times, sire, remember the Athenians." The Ionian Revolt was over. It was indeed time for the great king to remember Athens.